Fanboy Smackdown.
Today on Fanboy Smackdown, Episode 6, Tony and Tony Strike Back. We discuss the first three Kevin Smith films in Part 1 of our review of his work. Hello, this is Tony.
And Tony.
And this is Fanboy Smackdown, Episode 6.
Shit, do you think we make it this long? Oh, by the way, this episode will probably have a little bit of language, because this time we are talking about the first three movies of Kevin Smith. So there might be some topics that could get a little unavoidable.
Damn it, hell yes. That's exactly what we're talking about. The Kevin Smith films. Yep. By the way, if I had to rank our episodes, I would rank them 2, 6, 3, 5... 1, and then 4.
I think I might agree with that. It's, 2 is definitely, I think, our high point.
2.
That may be as high as we ever get.
That might be. So I think I'm going to pose the first questions to you, because you are more of an expert on Kevin Smith than I am. I've only recently seen the three films that we are going to discuss, what's called, I guess, colloquially, the Jersey Trilogy.
Right.
And I guess I would like to ask you, like, what your impressions were when you first saw them, like, what order you saw them in, what made you a fan, that sort of thing.
Well, if memory serves, I saw them, I saw either Chasing Amy or Clerks first, and I believe it was Chasing Amy first, and then, like, the next weekend, I went out and rented Clerks, and the weekend after that, I rented Mallrats. It was just, it was one of those things that I was aware of these films, being a comic book collector at the time. I'd seen the ads for Mallrats and some of the comic book magazines that, hey, Stan Lee's in this movie.
Right.
So I was, you know, I had that awareness of the films, but never really, you know, it was like, oh, Stan Lee's in the movie. What kind of gimmick is that? You know. But then I saw Chasing Amy, and it was like, boy, it was, you know, at the time I would have been about 26, and you know, it was the same age as the rest of these characters. Come to find out later that Kevin Smith is only about 6 months older than I am. So it's, you know, To see his movies as they're released for me, and knowing now that, you know, they speak a lot, in some points of them speak to his life experience, I can relate. I can completely relate. The guys in these movies, I know, you know, not directly, but I know these guys, you know.
Right.
Going back to Clerks, Randall and Dante were me and my buddy Chuck.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, people would look at us and say, you guys use big words,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
and it was just the way we were. But I think what really struck me with Chasing Amy was that it was a love story, and you know, and these movies are obviously not new movies, so there will be spoilers.
Right.
I don't think we need to hide any of the plot elements of any of these movies at this point.
Spoiler number one, the main character in it is not Amy. That's
yes.
A huge spoiler right there.
Yes. Yes, it's Alyssa. But just the fact that he unexpectedly falls in love with this woman, and she falls in love with him too, which... And she even says, you are the one least likely. You are not the one I should have fallen in love with. That was kind of cool. But then the ending sequence where it all just falls apart. I mean, it just brutally and violently, not physically violently, I mean emotionally violently, just crashes. And you really feel for it. I mean, you really feel what this guy's going through. And I mean, I don't know about you, but the first time I saw it happening... And he's standing in front of those two, proposing his, you know, the what will bond the three of them in friendship. And you can just see what he's where he's going, and you just know that, dude, you just need to shut up.
It was the it was very painful to watch. It was the one thing that I wasn't sure whether or not I believed it to be in the capacity of his character to do that. But I accepted it, and the movie is brilliant, by the way. I'm not saying that.
Yeah.
It was just, it was a little jarring because his character seemed so collected.
There was some foreshadowing to the moment, in the bar at the beginning, Mr. Cool, until he finds out that she's a lesbian,
right?
And then he does a little freak out.
He does
a little freak out. Then later on, he finds out about the finger cuffs,
right?
And he does another freak out. So I don't think it's outside of the capacity of the character
that he would think
he would jump to a major
conclusion. I need to avoid these freakouts by going this direction.
I need to jump in as deeply as I can to, and it goes along with Bob's big monologue at the end, where he basically says, you know, I thought that jumping in head first and getting to the same level as she was would put us on equal footing. And in fact, she had gotten past that point in her life. She was done with that. And
right.
And to her, that was a step backwards.
Not only that, but it was
and for him, he just felt
degrading,
like,
of her.
Absolutely.
As a human being, which is the other thing that bothered me about it. Like, accept it. Like, it was totally plausible, and I went with it. But it struck me that if he really loved her, and maybe he was just infatuated with her, maybe that's all it was, but if he really loved her like that, as a three-dimensional person, how could he see her suddenly so two-dimensionally? You know?
Well, and he thought the only way that he could be as three-dimensional as she was is to by having the same depth of experience.
Well, no, I don't mean it in that way. I mean, he does that huge speech in the car in the rain.
Oh, yeah.
And he professes this profound and deep love for her. And up to this point, knowing that where they've gone with their friendship, and that's all, you know, oh, you totally accept that.
Right.
Then when he suddenly, and maybe it's because of his fear, which is perfectly reasonable, his fear makes him an idiot. You and I are guys, we've been there, we've been in fear, and then we've been idiots and done things that we don't, would never, under reasonable circumstances, say.
Absolutely.
It just struck me as a surprise that he suddenly saw her as just a woman who's had these experiences that he needs to attain in a way.
Yeah.
But then again, I mean, I guess that's kind of how we all are. I mean, in a sense, I mean, we have to fight that, you know, within us, I guess, to an extent.
Yeah.
And
couldn't. In a way, we all keep score.
Right.
You know, and
right.
I think that was kind of the point of the character and the point of that moment, is that he felt the need to keep score. And she was past that. She was past that moment. She didn't need to.
Her love was actually more mature.
Absolutely.
Even though it was harder for her to accept at first.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And so that was my first experience was with Chasing Amy. And then I went back and saw Clerks. And I just knew. I knew I was in. You know. 37, man.
Now, Clerks, and I'm playing a bit of the devil's advocate here, but the problem I had with Clerks, not that it wasn't incredibly hilarious, but, and also Mallrats suffers a little bit from this too. Chasing Amy, pardon me, is many, many steps ahead of the first two.
Absolutely.
It is more believable.
Mm-hmm.
It is better written. It's one of the best romantic comedy dramas I've ever seen. But not to digress, The reason it's better than the other two, I would argue, is this point that the dialogue feels like theater in the first two, in that they are both reciting their lines and with the right intonation, but it's so quick, mm-hmm. it feels as if it's been over-rehearsed. And that bothered me a little bit about both of those, the first two films.
Well, you know, and it goes to also the level of acting that was in those films. In the first film, you had really the only person, I think, with any acting experience was Brian O'Halloran, Dante. And Jeff Anderson, the guy who played Randall, was just a guy who kind of wandered in, you know. The role was actually written for Kevin Smith. That's why Randall has all the best lines. Kevin Smith realized at some point that there was no way possible that he could direct and have such a major role in the film at this point in his career. And to this day, he still hasn't had that big of a role in a film that he's directed. So with that film especially, the acting talent in the film was Brian O'Halloran. And I think it showed. I mean, I think his character came off as well as any of them. Mm-hmm. Though I really did believe Randall's character, because in my mind, I was Dante and my friend Chuck was Randall. I mean, that was
right.
That was our relationship, and that was how we were. I was his straight man,
right?
You know,
right.
And that was the way it was. To the point that we would actually use that against people, but that's a completely different subject. moving on to Mallrats, I'm blanking on his name, Jeremy, whatever his name is, the guy that played T.S.
Okay.
He had a couple things under his belt. It was Jason Lee's first picture.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
He does extraordinarily well. I mean,
he does very well for it being his first picture.
He's a huge talent in that picture.
Yes, yes. Ben Affleck has a decent enough part in it, but it's one of his earlier works.
Right.
Shannon Doherty had already been on 90210 at that time.
Right.
But if I'm remembering correctly, she was even somewhat a diva at this point. There's a scene when William Black, the character that Ian Sibley plays, he turns around and he's the guy that's staring at the
right.
the collage and trying to see the sailboat. And he turns around and she's standing there and he says, "Brenda?" Which is her character from 90210.
Right.
She didn't know he was going to say that. That was... Somebody told him to say that and told him that she's cool with it. And her reaction was real. That was her real reaction to
that
moment.
That's great.
But, I mean, so you had a little more acting talent. Michael Rooker, Svenning.
Was he the...
The bald guy?
The bald guy?
Yeah.
Okay, I thought, and I could be wrong, I don't know much of his work, but I thought he was in The Deer Hunter when he was younger.
I'm not sure. We can look that up. But,
I thought he was the guy that becomes wheelchair bound in that movie. Spoiler, Deer Hunter, spoiler.
Yeah,
but
I'm not sure. I'd have to. We'd have to look that up. But he was just in an FX had an original series called Thief that aired not too long ago. He played a cop in that.
Okay.
He was also in Days of Thunder. Opposite of Tom Cruise.
Never seen it.
He was he played an opposing racer. But so those films didn't have as much acting talent. Not that Chasing Amy had a whole lot of acting talent, I mean, you still had a relatively
well.
I mean, you had Ben Affleck who had a couple of things, but not a whole lot. I think the one thing and it you first see it in Chasing Amy, and you see it again in Jersey Girl, which is the most recent Kevin Smith film. Kevin Smith knows how to direct Ben Affleck.
Yeah, Ben Affleck,
you know, if you ever watch these two movies and you only see these two movies of Ben Affleck, he's a good actor.
Right.
He's a
good I liked him for the actor. First time.
Yes.
After having seen Chase. Not that I didn't like him, like, let me put it this way. I didn't think he had a lot of talent.
He's handpulled.
I'm sure he's a nice guy and everything, but I don't think he's very talented until I've seen this movie.
He hams it up a lot. He smiles at the camera. He's a smile and a wink kind of guy.
Right.
He says everything with a smirk on his face, but that's just the look he has on his face.
Right.
But Kevin Smith knows how to direct him. He knows how to tell him to shut up and just say the lines the way I wrote it.
He did do a great job acting. In that film, Jason Lee did a great job. Joey yes. Lauren Adams did a great job. Even the lesser characters, I don't know who Hooper X is.
Oh, yeah.
But he was a fantastic character.
He was a great character.
And a good actor. Yes. You know? So, even to an extent, the lesser characters were strong in that film. That film is just all the way around really strong.
Absolutely.
And it also simultaneously breaks, you know, cultural ground. Without being as cliched as so many of the supposedly culturally groundbreaking films that, you know, we see. We're kind of overkilled with the nature of one's sexuality today. And the problem with it is that those characters are never fully developed, at least not in my estimation. Right. Not in the way that they all were with Chasing Amy.
Yes.
And the subject matter that was explored was actually explored with some authenticity, and it was not agenda-driven, which is what I really appreciated about the film.
Absolutely. It was a story about these characters. It wasn't about being lesbian, being
right.
bisexual, being gay, being heterosexual. It was about two people who fell in love.
Right.
And the struggles that they had to go through because of the baggage of their past relationships. Quite simply, that is Chasing Amy. In a nutshell, that is the movie. The same can be said for anybody over the age of, you know, 20, who's been in more than one relationship. In some way, they kind of get this movie, you know. If you've been in more than one relationship, you know that something's going to carry over.
Right.
The new person you're dating is going to have questions about the old person you're dating. You're going to have questions about people that person's dated in the past.
I think one
whether
of
you
the...
admit it or not, questions can come up, and it was his struggle with those questions, and her struggle with not really caring about the answers.
Right, and I think one of the really brilliant strokes of Kevin Smith in writing the character of Ben Affleck was writing him from a perspective which pretty much I would have to believe, although I could be wrong, most every adult male roughly that age perceives, you know, sex or even lesbians, you know, and that mm-hmm. sort of thing, and how he accepts to a certain extent the cliche, but he can't accept when his whole world is broken by the finger cuffs incident. All of a sudden, all the stereotypes that he accepted about who she was and that sort of thing. And Hooper actually does a bit of exposition on how he feels, which is because Hooper fully understands, you know, both the way, you know, homosexuality is viewed by heterosexuals, and he also understands, you know, that there is a gap between what how they understand themselves and how heterosexuals understand them.
Right.
So he articulates all of that and rather well. I mean, and it helped me understand actually a whole lot.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, and the great thing about the Hooper X character, I wish we would have seen more of the character throughout the film. It's just such a great character that that hides behind so many layers of stereotype.
Yeah.
I mean, he's really... He foreshadows the whole movie.
Yeah, you're right.
The opening sequences with him foreshadow pretty much the events of the whole movie.
And it's hilarious, man, because I, like...
Best line in this movie, the funniest line in this movie, and you have to see the movie to get the gist of it. So when Jason raises his hand and says,
what's a Nubian? I thought, well, isn't that true? Yeah. When he says that, I was dying. Oh my gosh. Yeah, that's a good scene.
And I can't remember the exact line, and it's like, some white boy has to go and quote the Holy Trilogy.
Yeah.
So, you know, and this kind of goes back to what we talked about in our first episode.
And his speech, which is lifted out of several different Malcolm X speeches.
Oh, yeah.
But appropriated for comic book purposes.
It's great.
Is very good, man. It's very funny.
Yeah, Chasing Amy is, until Jersey Girl, I would say is my favorite Kevin Smith film. And I'm not going to go into Jersey Girl now. That's
right. That's the next.
We'll talk about that the next time we talk about Kevin Smith. Up to this point, seeing the first three movies of the first three, I would go with that one as my favorite. I thought the writing was more mature
on Chasing Amy.
I thought the writing was more mature. I thought the dialogue was tighter and better acted.
Oh, definitely.
But still not afraid to... The one thing that I liked about it was the fear of being where he always was. And the writing, Kevin Smith, I mean, there was no fear to his writing. He wrote Chasing Amy with the same openness that he wrote Clerks, the same level of crudeness and honesty in language. I mean, you had every four letter word in that movie at some point. You had graphic descriptions of sex acts in the movie, and it's not that they were thrown in because it was naughty or it was something to titter at or it was just to get a rise. It's how people talk.
Right.
You're drinking beers at a bar with your friends. You talk about boobies.
Right. Exactly.
You might not even call them that.
I'll have to hang out at these bars where you go out and talk about boobies.
Tell me of such booby bars.
That's exactly what happens. And apparently I was watching some of the commentary and Kevin Smith said he was almost going to get hit with an NC-17.
Absolutely.
And he was going to be like, oh man, now I got to trim it back. But then apparently he just got the R and he was safe, which I guess... It was good. I mean, I've actually never seen an NC-17 picture.
I'm trying to think of the last NC-17 picture that was in wide release. Wasn't Passion?
Passion was not NC-17.
Okay.
It was an R rating. I know Natural Born Killers had an NC-17 version.
Yeah.
Showgirls did.
What about Temptation?
Last Temptation had an X rating before the
NC-17.
Right. Yeah. And that's amazing to me. But we can talk about that when we do our Scorsese thing.
Yeah. Now one thing, talking about the rating system in the MPAA, Kevin Smith and the MPAA have history.
Oh, really?
It goes all the way back to Clerks. The original cut of Clerks was going to be NC-17.
Really?
Miramax hired Alan... realign my tongue. Miramax
That's
hired...
That's one beer, folks.
Yes.
One beer.
And one beer. One beer, and there it all goes to hell. Miramax hired Alan Dershowitz to represent the film to the MPAA. With no cuts, he basically just re-presented the movie to them with no cuts, and they said, okay, we'll give it an R. Which, I mean, look at the movie Clerks. It's got harsh language. There's no violence.
Right.
There's no violence to speak of. There's hockey, but that's not, I mean, it's not even violent. I think the guys bump each other once or twice. You've got, there is a scene where Randall holds up a porno magazine. And if you're looking at the porno magazine, you see quite a bit.
Right.
It's a very quick scene. It's in grainy black and white. It's not that great a film stock.
I mean, the only film that has actual nudity in it was Mallrats.
Yes.
And
if I believe correctly, that was at a request of the studio.
Right, because they wanted
a quote, intelligent Porky's.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So, but that one got the R easily.
Yes.
Because they wanted to market that to a mass audience with a hard R.
Yes.
But these other two films, Chasing Amy, I can see because the subject matter, in terms of almost completely the dialogue, is all about explicitly.
Yes.
Sexuality and sex.
Yes. So
I can understand that. But Clerks, I really don't get that. I mean, that doesn't really make any sense to me.
Well, it was also 12 years ago.
Oh,
the movie came out in 94.
That's true.
And it didn't have a big studio behind it. I mean, Miramax was still pretty small at the time. Granted, if you follow that back, Miramax was still backed by Disney. But, you know, it wasn't like you were throwing a Tom Hanks or, you know, a Clint
right.
Eastwood movie out there.
Right.
I mean, this was a nothing little indie flick. Yeah, I mean, the MPAA has always been a part of...
I don't mean to digress, but it seems that the MPAA, I'm not sure which one it is.
MPAA.
Okay.
Motion Picture Association of America.
Okay. It seems that they used to be incredibly lax in the 70s, and then they really tightened up a lot in the late 80s and early 90s, and
sensibilities
now they're becoming relaxed
again. Sensibilities changed a lot. And a lot of it had to do with PG-13. And we're going to digress a little bit here. I think this is an appropriate digression. I don't think Kevin Smith would mind because it actually does focus on...
His troubles with them?
Well, not on his troubles with them, but on George Lucas, which he's a big fan of.
Oh, yeah.
The PG-13 rating was created because of Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom.
Oh, the Temple of Doom?
It was Temple of Doom. And it was specifically the scene where the guy pulls the guy's heart out of his chest. There's no way they would have given that movie an R. That's the only scene in the movie that with anything questionable, you know, anything remotely even questionable about it. That scene was probably a little too rough for PG, for straight PG. Then again, you have films like Airplane. The original cut of Airplane, which
fantastic picture.
If you've seen it, yeah. If you've seen it on video, DVD, or pay cable, there's a scene of nudity in it. There's a woman that runs through topless.
Right.
It's a PG movie.
Right.
There is swearing in the movie.
Yeah.
If the movie Airplane was made today, it would definitely get a PG-13. And would probably have to get cuts to get a PG-13, because I doubt
right.
that scene of nudity would be able to stay in.
You know, the difference is, in a way, there seems to probably be a sliding scale in that violence in film is much more widely accepted.
Oh, absolutely.
But it seems that
absolutely.
Language and nudity have been almost littered.
Yes.
Not that, I mean, it's not actually the case, but I mean... For relative perspective, you compare it to the 70s films,
mm-hmm.
and then what happened in the 80s, and then what's happened since then. And it would seem that that's the case. And I don't know why that is, except that explosions sell big blockbusters. And the big blockbusters evolved in the 1980s.
Right.
I mean, really.
Right.
So that might have a lot to do with it. It might all be money when you come down to it. And Kevin Smith's Clerks probably wasn't going to make $70 million, so they didn't mind slapping an NC-17 on it.
Absolutely not.
So, interesting.
But now we can pull back a little bit from our MBAA rant. We can do a whole show on that later.
Hey, that wouldn't be bad.
It wouldn't hurt my feelings.
We could watch.
I have plenty of things I could say about
them. We could watch all kinds of films from the '70s, you know.
Or we can watch a film of every rating.
There you go. There you go.
Let's see. I'm gonna go ahead and throw in a couple of pieces of trivia about the movies, just to kind of break up our discussion a little bit. A couple little fun facts about the movies. The original movie Clerks was made for $26,800. It was financed by credit cards, the sale of a comic book collection, and insurance money from Kevin Smith's car that was caught in a flood. He could have replaced his car. He used the money for the film. The rights to attain the cost of the rights that they needed to attain for the movie soundtrack cost $27,000, $200 more than it cost to make the film. It's the first time. It's the first time in film history that happened. The original ending of the film. I'm not going to ruin this for people because, you know, I'd like people to go out and see this one. There is a different ending of the film that was shown theatrically. It's available on the different cuts of the DVD that are available. Go check it out. There was an alternate ending. And it's surprisingly different than the way the original film ended. One thing that's pretty cool is the actual logo for Clerks. And the... Most people can look at it and recognize a few of the letters. I think the one for me that's most recognizable is the K, and I recognize that as the Clark bar. But the letters for that, the C is from Cosmopolitan magazine, the L is from Life magazine, the E is the ending E on Rolling Stone magazine, the R is from Ruffles, Bag of Ruffles, again, K is from the Clark bar, and the S is from Goobers. So
that's awesome.
Let's see, other little points about some of the other flicks. This movie, I said, was made for just under $27,000. Mallrats was made for just over $6 million. Chasing Amy was made for $250,000. So that's kind of interesting, and by all means, if you've seen these movies and you're a fan of the movies, I cannot give a higher recommendation than to pop that disc in again or go rent them and watch the director's commentary. Kevin Smith as a commentary is almost as entertaining as the movies in some cases. When he gets some of those guys together, I believe it's the Mallrats commentary that Jason Mewes is sleeping in front of the table that they're doing it in, that they're doing the commentary through. And at points through the commentary, you can actually hear him snoring. It's hilarious. It's hilarious. Kevin Smith is one that's known for pop culture references. They're all over the place in all of his movies. Some of the cool ones... In Clerks, you've got the salsa shark. So you've got the Jaws reference there. In Mallrats, the main characters are Brody and T.S. Quint. Brody and Quint are two of the characters from Jaws.
Oh, I didn't even know that.
Yeah. let's see. You've had actors play multiple characters. A couple of funny points. At the hockey game, Alyssa is talking about the two people that she was with, that she had the incident with, and those two people were played by, Chasing Amy. She says it's Shannon Hamilton and I can't remember the other
Gwen Turner, right? She mentions Gwen Turner.
Yeah. And those two characters are Ben Affleck and Joey Lauren Adams in Mallrats.
Right.
Which is kind of funny if you take a look at it. I believe the guy that played Shannon Hamilton in Clerks is sitting next to Ben Affleck in that scene also.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Guy was like, even I knew what she was getting.
Yeah. Yeah. But the only other thing that's really worth mentioning, just as quick bits of trivia, is that for anybody who only has a mild or a passing connection to these movies, the character Silent Bob is played by Kevin Smith, the writer and director of the films, and has probably some of what's the most poignant dialogue in all three of the movies. Well, not so much in Mallrats. His one big bit of dialogue is adventure, excitement, a Jedi craze, not these things.
Yeah, yeah.
The great one at the end of the Clerks, and I actually wrote this one down because I thought I remembered it, and I was about 99% there in doing it from memory, and it's, you know, there's a million fine looking women in the world, dude. But they don't all bring you lasagna at work. Most of them just cheat on you. I mean, it sums up the whole movie.
Yep.
It really does sum up the whole movie. And yeah, basically just telling Dante that he's a dumbass.
Yep. That's good stuff.
And, I mean, I think what I like the most about these films, the honesty in dialogue, but that your protagonist isn't the smartest guy in the film.
Right.
He's not the guy that has all the answers. In most cases, he's the guy that doesn't know what the hell that's going on and through most of it, and is the guy that you know may not win at the end of the movie.
Right. Exactly.
And it's okay. And it's still okay. It still turns out
easily
okay.
Identifiable by, you know, a lot of people.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, at the end of the day, you didn't get exactly what you wanted, but you know, you're still alive. I mean, there's still more to the story.
And they do, I mean, the characters do learn from their experiences in those pictures.
You like to hope they do, at least.
Well, I guess you don't really know, but you would assume, I think, based on the way they end, you know.
Sure.
That they would have learned, you know, something from those their experiences. So,
well, as let me, you know, you started this conversation asking me some of my thoughts. I want to get your take because I know that you're fairly new to the View Askew universe, as it's called. View Askew being the
production company.
What is your take on Jay and Silent Bob?
Well, they actually remind me of two friends of mine. Two very good friends of mine who are still my friends. Although, you know, Jay and Silent Bob, you know, they function as both the inside jokes of the film and as certain points of illumination in certain instances.
Well, especially Bob.
Yeah.
I mean, he very definitely takes on the sage character.
Right. So in that way, they're
he's
either
the Oracle.
Right. Yeah, exactly. In a way.
Mythologically speaking, he's the Oracle.
Exactly. And I don't know if either of my friends have been an Oracle, but no, I'm sure they've given me good advice before. They're good guys. But,
the question is, do they listen to the podcast and do they know who you're talking
right,
about?
Yeah, exactly.
He can't be talking about me. Say something.
If you know you're one of them, then you know who the other one is. I'll just put it that way. But I like them. I don't really have a feeling one way or another about them, except that they actually serve a purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And they also double as a elbow and a wink to anyone who's seen any other of the films.
Sure.
And so in that way, they're very effective for the director.
Right.
In making fans out of people who want to see other stuff of his work. They are rewarded for having seen more of his work because they understand on another level what is going on with all the references to previous works.
Certainly.
So in that way, I think they're very effective. Sometimes, when a point is driven home in a film, it bothers me a lot. But in a film that doesn't take itself too seriously, it's okay.
Right.
And that's what makes Kevin Smith's films work.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're not so full of drama that when they finally, you know, drive, they bang you over the head with the point, you know, so to speak.
Right.
You're like, oh my God, I knew this, you know. I figured this out after an hour and a half of melodrama.
Right.
Kevin Smith's films, you know, it's kind of like, hey, here's the deal.
And it's
within the context of the rest of the phraseology and the way they talk, which is why it works so well.
What I love about that and what you're talking about there is at the point when and normally it's Bob. And at the point when Silent Bob opens his mouth and says, you know, gives whatever enlightening advice he's going to give, the audience knows. The audience understands exactly what he's talking about. It's not a surprise to the audience.
Right.
But to the main character, they should have got it by now. And
right.
At this point, the audience saying, why don't you get it? It's somebody, it's Bob is the voice of the audience screaming at the television or screaming at the screen saying, get it, wake up.
In a way, yeah.
It's,
and they also provide great comic relief. I mean,
oh, yeah.
So,
yeah.
I mean, they actually serve a trifold purpose, really.
Snooch to the nooch.
Oh, man. It's good. I mean, I like the characters. And are they going to be in Clerks 2? Do you know this?
Yes. Yeah, they are going to be in Clerks 2.
Okay.
They're part of the trailers. So they're there. To digress just a bit, and this just kind of an interesting side story. Jason Mewes had a real drug problem, heroin addiction, just a real problem. There's a scene in Clerks, that last scene where Bob gives his spiel. He's drunk, and it's obvious. And if you go back and watch that film, take a look at Kevin Smith's face. He's pissed. He is just absolutely livid. The fumbling through the lines, the fumbling speaking, that's not acting. That's not acting like he's fumbling lines. He can't remember his lines. He's just fumbling his words through it. And it's because he's drunk. he had a big heroin problem to the point where you know, Kevin Smith actually said that he was never going to make another one of these movies. You know, he was done making movies. Jay and Silent Bob were done after Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back. You know, he was done with this group. But, and that's what he had always told the public. What he had told Jason Mewes was, dude, if you ever get your shit together, if you ever get your act cleaned up, we'll do another movie. We will
so
do
this
it.
Is a reward.
This is a reward.
Well, that's really classy. That's really classy.
He kicked him. I mean, he let him stay at his house for a long time. He kicked him out of his house at one point because of his using. I believe to this point he actually lives in Kevin Smith's house again. He's part of their family. He's married, has a child. Kevin Smith's married, has a child. They live in Ben Affleck's old crib. He bought Ben Affleck's old house. From what I understand, he didn't pay nearly as much as it could have been worth.
Well,
but
that's cool.
But you know, and I mean, I know a lot of these stories, but these stories aren't insider knowledge. Most of the stuff that I'm telling you is available. It's Kevin Smith makes himself extremely available on the internet. You know, anybody can go post on the message boards on his websites. And has an equal chance that he'll answer a question or comment on something somebody says. He's always made himself extremely available via the internet. And when we get to the next couple of movies, one of the major points in Jay and Silent Bob is the proliferation of opinions on the internet. And which was kind of the, you know, the impetus for part of the Fanboy Smackdown
too. Right.
But yeah, I mean, he loves the guy. And
yeah.
And it's and Clerks 2 is part of the reward for cleaning up. And I've seen interviews recently with Jason Mewes, and even looking at the trailers, he has definitely gotten bigger. He's more physically, he's more buff.
Right.
He's just
healthier, probably.
He's healthier.
Quitting.
His eyes look clear. So that's just a little side note.
Cool.
Again, all this stuff is available. It's all on his commentaries. Something else we're, you know, I don't think we're going to plan on talking about as far as on the podcast, at least looking at it as a whole, but something I recommend is a DVD set that's An Evening with Kevin Smith, and it's a collection of his speeches at comic book conventions, and I was fortunate enough to be at the Chicago Comic Con in 2001, right before the release of Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back, and he spoke at it. It was a pretty surreal experience because I actually went into the hall where he was going to be speaking like 3 hours before he was going to be there and sat through the other panels. They tried to clear the room of people who had sat in that hall all day knowing that he was going to be there. What we didn't realize, the people inside, was that there had been people waiting outside lined up the whole time also.
Wow.
To the point where they called the fire marshals in, and they were going to have us escorted out of the building. We would not leave. It was a surreal experience.
And, wow.
They were going to try to kick us out of the building, and we just stayed. And we finally got to see him. We, you know, they finally just said, "Fine, screw it, let him stay."
It's cool.
And I got to go to a preview of Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back later that night. So that was really cool because it was Jason Mewes and Kevin Smith were there. Some of the other View Askew guys were set up at a View Askew booth that they were selling some of their merchandise and got some of their autographs. So that was all very cool. So yeah, I'm a little bit of a fanboy. I'll admit it.
We're here to smack you down. That's what this podcast is all about.
That's okay. That's all right.
Well, all right. I mean, I guess that just about wraps it up for us.
Yeah, we don't have any extra feedback. Then again, we kind of blew through all the feedback last time.
Yeah, but yeah, the last episode was about feedback. So to get feedback about an episode with feedback would probably be a little redundant.
We did talk about Nevsky, though.
We did talk about Nevsky,
and you know,
Steve actually said thanks for mentioning.
That's true.
You know,
that's true.
He did pass that along. So yes. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Steve. And when the other Tony gets off his butt, we'll have a promo to you.
That's right. That's me.
And hopefully we'll have a promo post. Wait a minute. Let me a promo posted in the feed. Sometime.
One beer, folks.
Yes.
One beer.
One beer. We'll have the rest of them after we stop recording. We will have a promo in the feed sometime this week, so everybody has a chance to listen to that. Give your comments on that. Let us know what you think. If you have any feedback on this episode, please feel free to give us a call at the Fanboy Smackdown line. That's 206-339-FBSD, 206-339-3273, or FanboySmackdown@gmail.com. Also, I've recently I recently joined Skype and have left my Skype ID up, and it's just Fanboy Smackdown on Skype. So if you're on Skype and you see Fanboy Smackdown on, shout out, give us a holler, say hello, and just let me know that you noticed us, you know, you've listened to the show, and I'll add you, and we'll have a chat. I think that about wraps it up for tonight, and we'll see you next week. Thanks for listening.
Amen, brother.
Snoogins.